The Crossroads today is a vibrant destination. You can swing by several galleries, dine in fancy restaurants, get artisan anything, and satisfy your love of people watching among the artists, patrons of the arts, hipsters, and business lunch crowd. But in the 1980s, it was a ghost town. Jim Leedy, who just celebrated his 85th birthday, was the first artist to hatch a plan for the neighborhood, but the plan wasn't drawn up in a boardroom. From his ceramics studio, which is still on the main drag of the Crossroads, he tells the story of how it all began.
I'm Jim Leedy. I'm an artist in Kansas City. I started Crossroads several years ago. When I came here to teach at the Kansas City Art Institute in the mid-60s, I realized there was no place for artists to show. And so I went to Westport and opened a gallery there. I was going to start an artist community in that area, but then it gentrified. So I started looking around, and I drove through this area, and it was blighted. All the old buildings were warehoused or closed down. I thought, well, this is a good area. So I bought a building here in about mid-70s. It was completely run down, and I didn't have the money to hire people, so I renovated it myself and started the Leedy Vocus Gallery. I put studios in the building so that the rent from the studios would pay for the mortgage and the electricity. And then I put a gallery in, and it worked. I'd finish one studio and someone would move in. I finished another studio, and someone else would move in, all artists. So it was very obviously a needed thing. Then I started buying other buildings. They were very cheap at that time. Then I would sell them for the same price that I bought them to artists. And so the area developed that way. I made no money doing that. I just did it to create an art center where artists could live cheaply and work and exhibit. And that's the way it got started. I spread the word myself. When I moved here in the 60s, there were no galleries. And there was no art. Art was in the universities, but there was no place for artists to work and live and our reason to stay here. We have the best school in the country, and all of our students go somewhere else. Go to school, graduate, go to New York, was basically the system. That has changed now. So as they graduate, I'd rent a cheap space for them to stay here. That's the way it really began. My friend John O'Brien, who I brought in here very quickly, we didn't know what to call the area, so it was called Leedy Town. And I said, no, John, let's find out what its real name is, this area. And he went downtown and went through the archives and found out this was, in the olden days, was called the Crossroads. And so that's what it is then, it's the Crossroads.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to trace the development of the Crossroads from back when it was still called Leedy Town or Leedyville until now. Later in the show, we'll explore the current debate around whether new projects in the neighborhood should still qualify for tax abatement, given how desirable the area has become, but that's a conversation for later. I'd like to introduce our first guest, the guy Jim Leedy just mentioned, John O'Brien. He ran the Dolphin Gallery, one of the first to set up shop in the Crossroads, and he's credited with starting First Fridays. Hi, John.
Good morning.
How do you remember those early days Jim Leedy was just describing?
I remember at the time the city was trying to make an art neighborhood in the city market or the River Quay. And roughly within 2 days, I looked at the River Quay, and then Jim Leedy came and picked me up where my shop was on 39th Street on State Line.
What kind of shop?
It was I've always been a junker, so it had lots of objects, and also my frame shop was there. And then I was curating little shows that were in restaurants back then.
Gotcha.
Almost little salon shows that were in restaurants that I liked.
So you went and checked out the city's project that it had going on for artists kind of in the city market and Jim Leedy's project in what would eventually be the Crossroads
yes.
on the same day.
Yeah, and down in the city market, I was offered free rent, and they were going to pay to move me. And Morgan Gallery was down there, an established gallery, and then Jim was starting his thing. And I fell in love with Jim. And I had to sign a lease and build my own space out, put my own air in, and move myself. But it was the right thing because it felt freer.
Talk to me about falling in love with Jim. You didn't know him at that time?
You know, I knew him from the Art Institute, but he was just such a figure that, you know, he could just kind of towered, walked on kind of holy ground. And I had talked to him before, but I remember he picked me up in his van and half-smoked cigars and ceramics and all sorts of stuff in this messy van. And he came by the shop on 39th and picked me up, and then we started talking about his dream, about a neighborhood. And we looked at the space, and it was rough. It's where Sherry Leedy is now, completely remodeled. And we went up into his studio and rode this elevator up to the top of the building. And
a freight elevator.
A freight elevator. And if you've been on the Leedy Volca space on the concrete side, that's how big the floor plate of his studio was at the time. And I walked in, I felt like I was in a shrine or a temple. And he proceeded to tell me kind of what he wanted to do. And immediately I knew that I had to jump on with him and made arrangements to move my shop off 39th Street and then come down with him and try to start doing shows. At that time, I didn't have a gallery, but I was very much involved with artists and stuff. So I moved my frame shop in the back, and then we had shows in the front.
What year are we talking about?
Yeah, I was trying to think that. I think it might have been like 91.
You know, I grew up in Kansas City, and even though I know I must have passed through what we now call the Crossroads in my parents' car fairly often in the 80s, the first conscious memory I have of being there is from the mid-90s. I was home from my first year of college on winter break, and I went with my dad to Architectural Salvage. It was on Broadway and Southwest Boulevard like it is now. I went to school in New York and was, I'm ashamed to say, very down on Kansas City at the time. But I remember looking around and wondering where the heck I was, because this neighborhood had a really alluring quality, a visual quality, like gravel alleyways and brick buildings with old painted advertisements fading on the surfaces. And even the emptiness of the streets was kind of romantic. It was the beginning of my being tempted back home. And I wonder if you can sort of set the scene visually for what you encountered in the Crossroads at that time around 1991.
Leedy had his gallery up on Wyandotte, and then he had an art center that was kind of still doing some shows. But Baltimore, there was no Lydia's, or that building was almost a dead-end road down there. And we were kind of isolated. Leedy moved the main gallery, Leedy Volkas, next door into the art center, and we kind of tag-teamed. And then right after that, Society for Contemporary Photography came in, and then shortly after that, Byron Cohen and Lenny Berkowitz. So there was four of us kind of on a street, and then Stretch. And then, of course, you know, our good friend David Ford, a wonderful artist that creates just amazing energy and is still a real force in that neighborhood.
So but he had a gallery there at the time.
David was always on the edges, and all of us kind of like being on the edges a little bit back then. You kind of had to be in the know a little bit. But there's definitely a lot of romance about the time period, but there's still some wonderful things that happened down there, and everybody has their moment in history kind of a little bit, and today is history. And there's things that are down there really wonderful, magical, that are happening right now today.
That will be history.
That will be history.
So we've talked about some of the characters who were there. Talk about the social scene in those early days.
You know, in the early days, sometimes some of us would just do our openings when we wanted to, and then sometimes try to coordinate. Lots of young people. I definitely was younger back then. And
that's usually the direction it moves.
Early on, I told Jim that we would have music in my space, and we would definitely, have a real social environment and a meeting place where people could come together. And there were some really wild parties back then, and then just wonderful conversation. I think artists are really amazing to be around. I'm not an artist myself, but I'm very attracted to artists and just their lifestyle and how their minds work.
Where did people go for like coffee or a bite to eat at the time? What were their options, or was it sort of making stuff on a grill in the back or something?
I think there's always been a history of us cooking ourselves, but there was Town Topic, Hereford House, but a lot of us maybe didn't go to Hereford House in the early days. Definitely supported a lot of the restaurants down on the west side.
Which at the time were not necessarily the ones now. I mean, a few of them.
No, there was always, you could always go get a good taco or something on down the street. And then there was West Side Cafe in the early days. And then right after that, Boulevard Cafe, which really changed the landscape of the neighborhood.
And that's where La Bodega is now?
It is. And there was art shows there. A lot of us hung out at the Boulevard Cafe, which is owned by Nuri and Adam Jones. Maybe the first tapas in the Midwest.
The story of Jim Leedy insisting that the district must have a name and kind of sending you off to find out what it was, I think that's a cool story. Can you tell it from your perspective?
I think we were kind of a street, even though some of us were spread out, and it seemed like that artists are very good at theater, kind of, or perception of things, and twisting and telling stories. And we were starting to grow, and there was stuff happening. There was galleries up on the west side, the Red Chair Gallery, and there was things kind of like spread around. So I ended up, there was a little bit of a change of a story before just going down to the city. I was invited by Michael's Clothier, Gene Navore, who the suit clothing store is still there. It's been there many, many years. And I was invited to a businessmen's luncheon. And there was no women there, as far as I remember. And it was in the back room of Hereford House. And I went, and there was maybe six old guys there and myself. And they had little printed off sheet of the minutes of the meeting that had happened before. And I stuffed one of those papers in my pocket, and I went back to the shop. And later I dug it out, and on the top it said Crossroads Businessmen's Meeting Group with the date on it. And I think it might have been the next day I went back up to talked to Gene at his clothing store, and we sat in the back room, and I said, "What is this?" And he said, "It's the name of the neighborhood." The neighborhood had been kind of lost, and it wasn't really considered downtown for many, many years, and even years after First Friday. Downtown was considered by many just to be the Loop, and I used to argue
a lot. The 435 Loop.
Yes, around the, I kind of call it the moat. Around the castles a little bit. But definitely, I think we're in a moment now where everybody's trying to embrace what we have. The city is in a renaissance, and things are really pushing forward. I think Crossroads has played a big, big part on that.
You mentioned a second ago even when First Friday started. Can you tell us the story of First Friday's getting started? When was that?
I used to kind of set a schedule in the fall where we would open up. Sometimes August are really slow, people are traveling, and in September it would usually be a First Friday. And we used to get some phone calls from some people and say, "Oh, do you have an opening on First Friday?" And
because it would happen sometimes, but not other times?
Not all the time. And then sometimes those phone calls were kind of aggravating, like you would say, "Oh, those crazy people, like, what are they talking about?" And you'd hang the phone up. But after 9/11 happened, it was a very scary time for business, for those of us that had businesses to try to support retail. And I remember looking out the window, and I just thought, I need to hang on. I can't be one of the first ones to be knocked down. And I thought, how do we? We're all individuals, and we like doing our own thing and not being told what to do. But I had an idea that we should band together. So I think it was maybe in January after 9/11, where we were all sitting around just watching TV, scared. And I called a meeting, talked to Susie Aaron, and she thought it was a good idea.
And she's a developer, real estate person who's very active in the Crossroads.
And she was very involved in Society for Contemporary Photography in the early days. Both of us brought them down right next door to the Dolphin. But I think it was kind of timing where everybody was kind of afraid and sitting at home watching TV. And it came out of trying to organize us together as a group. I wish I would have taken a picture who was there, but I remember I stopped and got Lamar's Donuts and we made coffee, and there was a handful of us there, probably about 8 or 9 of us at that little morning meeting in the Dolphin. And I said, either we're going to die individually or we die together. And I think we agreed in January that we would try to do something. And then the first one was in March. And I remember calling Alice Thorson and said, could you please put it in the paper? And I think it was a moment of time where people, just within the group, we kind of spread the word, and then many people came out, and it was like a private party that we all got to hang out and embrace one another. And then the next one got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Did you ever have a clue that this thing you guys were doing could turn into not just an arts destination for the whole city, but a destination for the city, period, like with high-rent condos and advertising agencies and some of the fanciest restaurants in town, not to mention parking congestion?
I've always liked the parking problems because, to me, that's an asset. It's somehow working. You can never, when you're in the moment, even dream bigger than what it is. We never thought it would be that big. I think all of us kind of know that from other cities that there is development that happens, and there are pressures in the Crossroads now to try to maintain. Other cities have dealt with them. I think a city our size, we need to be really smart and really careful as we move forward to try to maintain what we have and continue building on what we have. And because sometimes it can be very fragile and it can disappear. And if you make a mistake, you can't get it back.
Let's get David Dowell in on this. He's a principal architect for El Dorado, whose offices have been in the Crossroads since 1996. Hi, David.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Tell me about yourself and your own history with the Crossroads, how you remember it maybe growing up, and then when and how it really caught your attention later on.
Well, I think, like you, I grew up here, and I don't have any memory of the Crossroads from high school. Ran away to college in St. Louis and Berkeley, California, then moved to Europe, lived there for a while, was headed back to California, and we stopped, my now wife, Kathy, and I stopped just to check in with our parents and hang out, and I have to disclose my mother-in-law is Susie Aaron.
Who we just described.
Who we just talked about. And Susie had a master plan to hook us into Kansas City. And you know, at the time, I don't even really remember the naming issue. And this was 1996 when we moved back. So I have a personal story, and then it evolved into a professional story, which, you know, very hard for me to distinguish the two. And it has a lot. Both of those storylines have everything really to do with the evolution of the Crossroads. So we, you know, we found a great place to live. It happened to be above the Dolphin Gallery.
So that's what, 19th in Baltimore.
20th in Baltimore. Yeah, the Opie Brush Building has the great sign outside. And that's how we got to know John and the Dolphin, and it's how between John and Susie and then Jim and Dan Clothier and all these people that were all these characters that you guys were starting to talk about, everybody overlapped, and there was a synchronicity in I would say an ambition about shaping a place in a way that would allow all of us to be in Kansas City and be proud of being there, not feel like there was a reference, you had to reference some other place.
You know, back in 2001, when I worked for The Pitch, you told me during an interview we had then that what you both loved and hated about the Crossroads was its potential. Here's what you had to say exactly. You said, Kansas City has always been a city of potential. I get sick of it being that way. I want it to be realized potential. Talk to me about what that has to do with the Crossroads.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I knew you would bring that up.
How?
I just knew it. Because at the time, it wasn't a premeditated thought, but it really captured both the frustration and the attraction. I don't think, you know, I happen to be an architect and those kind of feelings, you know, attached to architectural things in my brain, but I think there was a real desire to have a place that was recognizable as authentic, interesting. You know, John said absolutely in a way that resonates that, you know, people wanted to shape this thing. They didn't want to move into a place that had a predetermined identity. And I think, you know, growing up in Kansas City, you could always feel like there was another plan, there was another idea about a neighborhood or, you know, like something going on somewhere that was this time going to make a difference and stick. And, you know, I think the Crossroads has become the sustained place where a lot of people can hang their dreams, their ambitions, their desires. And it's a work in progress. I mean, we've just started. It's been 20 years. It's been more than 20 years. And there's still a ton of work to do.
Talk to me about the projects professionally that you took on in the neighborhood early on and what they taught you about both the challenges to revitalizing the area and the opportunities.
Sure. Well, we've renovated dozens of buildings in the Crossroads. We've also worked on bridges in the Crossroads, and we've worked on streetscape projects. We're working on new buildings now. We've worked on policy projects. The Greater Downtown Area Plan is a policy project that we worked on. So we've really seen the neighborhood from and gotten to know people from a lot of different perspectives. And each one of those projects, rather than thinking about them as buildings, because that's people often mistake what we do as dealing with buildings, what we actually deal with are people and their financial goals, their what they want to do for a living, how they live, how they work, how they play. So in many ways, we've been really fortunate to be able to sustain a practice of now 25 people for 20 years. Really, the heart and soul of our practice is rooted in work in the Crossroads. We're doing work elsewhere now too, but so it's people.
What can you tell me about a specific project from your very first years in the Crossroads that really taught you specific things about the buildings and the people and the neighborhood?
How far back should I go?
Just any time within those first few years you were operating in the Crossroads.
Project number two, project number three for El Dorado. Project number one was a Art Institute project. Project number two was the building that Fine Folk is in now. Project number three is the building that is currently occupied by Michael Smith and Extra Virgin. And at the time, Matt McFarland was a young graduate of the Art Institute, a photographer, and had the ability to purchase the property. I think he probably didn't pay very much for it, which was a very common story at the time. You know, the city really didn't know what to do with this building stock. Building renovations were, I think, in the Crossroads, if people renovated buildings, they did it in a way that Jim described, where people just did what they needed to do. We're architects. We had to go through building permitting processes and dealing with contractors and budgets and things like that. And I think we were all learning how to do that in a way that was cost effective, but also really honored this kind of, I'll keep calling it ambition, to create an authentic place. So we were really careful. We, you know, careful about the historic fabric and what to do with it. not slavish in any way to kind of recreating some moment in time, but honoring the fabric. I think it's undeniable that one of the most attractive things, you said it, others have certainly said it, that one of the most attractive things about the neighborhood is the physical fabric. And, you know, it's exciting to think about how that is shaped moving forward.
Something else we talked about back in 2001 were early concerns at that point among those artists who'd paved the way for development that they would end up getting priced out. How has that whole dynamic unfolded from your perspective?
Well, certainly property values are higher now than they were then. There have been mechanisms put in place to maintain a certain type of activity. The Arts District PIA is a tool that was developed. I was just a supporter and a fan of it.
What does PIA stand for?
Planned Industrial Expansion Authority. And it's one of the, you guys will talk about TIF. PIA is another tool in the economic development toolkit that Kansas City, Missouri has to incentivize the risk that developers take when they renovate properties. So the Arts PIA basically motivates property owners to occupy their buildings with SIC codes that are in the creative arts. So graphic arts, boutique producers, architects, kind of a broad array of quote unquote cultural producers. So that's one way. But also, you know, a lot of artists found a foothold. Jim has a good foothold in the neighborhood. I'm thinking about, you know, Warren Rosser has a studio in the Crossroads that we helped him with. The Studios Inc. Is an incubator. That's a terrible word. It's a facility that offers incredible space to artists. You know, early on when the debate was or the discussion about how the neighborhood's going to unfold. It's been a nonstop point of discussion, as you can imagine. If you talk to artists, they want space. They want space to work. They want the ability to connect with an audience. Some want to own property, but that's not the top priority. So, I think just because of the natural evolution of the neighborhood and the pace, which is relatively slow. You know, which is a good thing. I think a lot of artists were able to get a foothold in the neighborhood to create, permanent home for themselves.
John O'Brien, what's your perspective on this? The dynamic involving artists being priced out versus being able to maintain a foothold in this neighborhood.
I also was a proponent of the PIA. It's kind of almost like an incentive that would try to make almost one developer steal a creative person from another one. And with that, then if their building was occupied by somebody who was creative under a certain guideline, then their taxes were held. There was many of our taxes early on. Jim Leedy's taxes were raised 300% before the PIA.
Whoa.
And that was maybe 10 years ago. So what's coming down the road could really impact very, very big on about 24 different properties that are involved in the PIA arts. And it's a very small amount of money. It's kind of like, what is the impact of First Friday? And a lot of these things cannot be kind of measured on a regular traditional spreadsheet that you would look at as a business model, because what we're dealing with is not a business model. So I think we're at a critical point, but we're also a very lively city. I try to not just think about a neighborhood, I think of a city.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, more on the story of the Crossroads. If you were hanging out in the area in the 80s or 90s, give us a call, add your 2 cents to the conversation. And if you weren't, but you have a question about the neighborhood's transformation, go ahead and ask it. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back.
At the Lord above, I'm
I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Today's show is all about the crossroads, hence the bluesy tune by Robert Johnson. My guests are John O'Brien, who ran one of the first galleries in the neighborhood, The Dolphin. John was the original force behind First Fridays. And we've also got David Dowell in the studio. He's an architect who's been working in the Crossroads since 1996. His firm is El Dorado. You can join our conversation about how the Crossroads became a premier arts district and an overall place to be in a span of about 25 years by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Guys, I remember kind of what I would call an awkward phase for the Crossroads, a period when the Crossroads was a place where most of the city did know about as far as First Fridays went, and people kind of flocked for that event, but stayed away still most of the rest of the time. It was almost like this was a neighborhood that was a tourist town within the city. About 30 days of the month, artists were kind of partying there, and then on the 31st day, the townies cleared out and the rest of the city filed in, and suddenly the galleries and streets overflowed. It was like a split identity, and it was hard to tell what direction things were ultimately going to take. What are your thoughts about that transitional period around the early 2000s?
You know, it was kind of tough. I always had young artists work at the Dolphin and students. And when First Friday started early on, they were like, they remembered the days before. And they were like, this is garbage. This is commercial. It took a little bit of time. And then those younger artists, that became their history. And then they claimed it and they owned it. And then, so everything kind of has a moment and stuff there. It was difficult. I mean, it was a deserted neighborhood. And we had First Friday, everybody jammed in. And then there was empty streets again. And then a lot of us had to have destination businesses where the people knew where we were, and there was businesses layered behind things like my frame shop and stuff. But it's definitely something that has really latched on, but I think it also is a very fragile thing still. I think the neighborhood is still very young. It's still got a lot to go. No matter how much people try to shape and mold things, you can. It needs to be organic. It can't have too much of a big overlay. And there's only so many people that have say open their doors on First Friday, but there's all these other layers that support that, and other businesses around and stuff to build a community is a really complicated thing. In the early days, Jim kind of told me, kind of laid the groundwork. I wish that we would have recorded it. He studied with Buckminster Fuller, who's a visionary. Jim left New York and actually told me about some of ideas of Fuller, and then he also added his own ideas and laid the groundwork early on, and I think we're still working on that.
You think we're still working on that same groundwork?
I do, of what Jim originally told me, yeah, about what it takes to build a community.
Some of the basic tenets of, I mean, I know that you can't remember verbatim what he told you, but some of the main ideas that you think we're still seeing play out today.
You know, like Jim said, there really wasn't a community, and communities, and also it takes economics and takes help from a city. In the early days, a lot of us would, like David said, we would just got in, no permits, just did it.
David, can you identify key moments or milestones between those early days we've described and what we see there now?
Yeah. Key milestones. Personally, moving back in the spring of 96 and being intrigued by the place. I can't remember specific moments. It's a fluid evolution.
I think of maybe very recently the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, a project like that. That is a different scale of project.
It is. And that's, you know, I mean, I was thinking in terms, while you guys were talking, I was thinking in terms of complexity. And in a way, in the early days, it really was about, cultivating, in a way, the soul of a place and lots of people feeling synchronicity around this idea, whatever it is. And it's always dangerous to try to put words to what it is. But it's grown in complexity. So these complexity shifts that Kaufman is certainly one. Now that you've properly prompted me, Streetcar is another that is going to change the dynamics of this neighborhood. I think the John leaving is another.
The Dolphin, yeah, John. The Dolphin went to the West Bottoms and then eventually closed. But can you talk about your decision to leave the Crossroads? That must have been hard after being in it from the beginning.
You know, I think early on, and Jim and I had a talk, and it was a hard talk for me to tell him that it was time for me to kind of go and kind of think about another neighborhood. But when Jim and I got together, we were talking about something for the city. And the Crossroads is something for the city. And it wasn't the Crossroads back then. It wasn't Leedy Town. What Jim described to me was something as a gift to the city. Art is always being made. And art is usually a very private thing. And I think what Jim instilled in many of us is that we were to open up and let others view in. And if artists have to move out of the Crossroads, that doesn't mean that they're not making art. It doesn't mean that we're not hanging out in studios or having private showings or conversations. I think the real pivotal moment was Jim kind of trying to convince some of us to open our doors and let people in, let people be witness to what creative people that we had here. You know, a big pivotal moment for me was, for David Ford to come down into the neighborhood and be, and he still stands there very strong.
At YJ's.
Yes. And in much more, it's a complex. In the early days, Stretch was amazing, just a block away.
But can we back up, just in case some people aren't familiar with what you're talking about? When you say that David Ford and what he's doing is more than YJ's, it's a complex, can you explain that? You're talking about 18th Street between Baltimore and Wyandotte.
Yeah, you have Peggy Nolan, wonderful designer, and you have Birdies there. And, you know, just a building, a complex full of creative people, retail shops, David's studio, other artist studios, music in alleyways, Mardi Gras, community jazz music on Sunday night. Hadley has a clothing shop there, a wonderful designer that I feel very inspired when I go into her shop and talk to her. It's world class on that street.
David, is there something that we can learn from the founding story of the Crossroads that's relevant to the questions and issues the district faces today? I mean, we've referenced a couple of times that there is still fragility in the neighborhood and still a lot to be done in the neighborhood, even though I think a lot of people do see it as like success story. It's done.
Well, it is a success story in the number. I think if one metric that would be interesting to develop would be how many people are in Kansas City, but for the cross, if the Crossroads wasn't what it is, how many people that are in Kansas City doing really important work wouldn't be here. I don't know how you do that, but it'd be a great metric to have. The fact is the work's not done, and it's grown in complexity there.
What is there left to do?
Well, it's a lot of buildings have been renovated. I know you guys are going to be talking about the Helzberg TIF, B&I TIF, and I'm a fan of that project for what it's doing in terms of continuing to elevate aspirations, which I think is a really important part of almost every activity, public and private, that goes on in the Crossroads. The idea of addressing this question of potential, the Crossroads is the most, in my opinion, the most active, dynamic, and complex organism in Kansas City that is working towards defining this idea of potential, a place that we all want.
As we get ready to embark on this conversation about TIF, that's tax increment financing, where developers bring new life to blighted properties or blighted communities in exchange for tax breaks, what are your basic thoughts about how TIF has shaped the area, the Crossroads, as we know it today?
You know, in the early days, Dan Clothier, very building that, the fire marshal told me he didn't care if it burned down. And that's where we have Lydia's and Grunauer's, a meeting place in the neighborhood where many of us go to. That building would have not been saved. It was a very successful project, and it paid back very quickly ahead of time. I think TIF is very confusing for some people. It's not free. It's basically there's a building there, on simple terms, and that building is assessed at a value. And if somebody comes in and dumps other money into it, then its property is going to go up. And those taxes are kind of held at that moment and not assessed for that higher investment.
Well, John O'Brien, David Dowell, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When KCUR Central Standard, we will get into the nitty-gritty of what TIF is anyway and how it works in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. And we're back. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm your host, Gina Kaufman, and we just heard the story of how the Crossroads transformed from a gritty playground for artists into one of the prized destinations of the city. TIF has been a part of that story for a while. Now, controversy over a proposed new Crossroads headquarters for BNIM that has Shirley Helzberg seeking $5 million in public subsidies is bringing TIF into the headlines once again. Lots of folks are saying that the Crossroads is no longer a blighted area that requires public subsidies in order to grow. Here to help us understand what we're even talking about is Steve Vakrot, a reporter for The Pitch who doggedly covers development issues in the city. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
I think we should back up several steps because TIF is an acronym that gets thrown around all the time in the news. But even those of us who follow the news, who have been hearing about this for a while, don't necessarily know its history or how it's supposed to work. So what does TIF stand for and what's the basic idea behind it?
Sure. So TIF stands for Tax Increment Financing. And it's an idea that's been around for a long time. It's got passed in Missouri in the 1980s. And it's a way, you know, the intention is to help a developer take a chance on a place that is determined to be blighted or is a conservation area.
How do we define blight and who determines whether an area is quote unquote blighted?
Well, that's really one of the big cruxes of this whole TIF controversy is blight is such a squishy term, especially even as it's spelled out in state law. It's not totally clear. And anytime you have ambiguities in the law, you have a lot of room to maneuver within it. And it's also very subjective. I mean, one person's blighted area is another person's treasured destination. And so the way blight is determined is there's an organization in Kansas City called the Economic Development Corporation. They hire a consultant to survey an area and determine whether they find blight.
What is the argument for development in a blighted area getting funding? I mean, we just heard this story of artists at least beginning the transformations of the Crossroad totally organically.
Right. And, you know, the way artists start to do things organically, it's more of a low-cost proposition, not to them, but in the grand scale of things. You know, what the artists and the pioneers were doing in the Crossroads is much different than what BNIM is, or Shirley Helzberg is attempting to do with BNIM. That's a
which 13. Is what? What are they trying to do?
They're trying to do a new headquarters building out of an old empty warehouse space that Shirley Helzberg has owned since about 2005, and they want to turn it into what they describe will be a very innovative, economically friendly building. It's a $13 million project. And with TIF, that would throw off about $5 million in future taxes to help defray the cost of her development. So that's 38% of the project cost would be coming from what are called incremental taxes. So it's taxes that will be developed in the future going forward. So it's real money. But it's not like Shirley Helzberg's getting a suitcase full of cash up front from the city and from the county and the school district to pay for this thing. It's over time increases in property taxes as this old warehouse space becomes something much nicer than what it is. And as BNIM employees move in and start working there, like half of their earnings taxes will be used to help with the development costs. If there's a restaurant or some sort of retail on the ground floor, portion of that sales tax will be used. Those are all the public sources of financing as they grow over time that will be used for the development that won't otherwise go to the city, to the county, to the school district if the development was done without TIF, if that's clear.
Yeah. So from a practical standpoint, if, say, I was a person who was taking on some big project and hoping to use TIFF to offset the cost to help me take this risk, walk me through the process I would go through in order to pursue TIFF funding.
Well, you would have to hire an attorney. And there's a group of attorneys in this town that do a lot of this work. And they're very influential in local politics. They donate a lot of money to campaigns, local political campaigns, city councils, things like that. And so they're very involved in this whole process, both practically and politically. And you would apply through the Economic Development Corporation, which is, they call it a quasi-governmental organization. I mean, you don't elect anybody with the Economic Development Corporation, but they're funded by the city and they're funded by the revenues that these projects generate. And they will do an analysis. Then you go before a TIFF commission, which is appointed. It's an 11-member board. It's six of the members are appointed by the mayor of Kansas City. Two members are appointed by the school district where it's happening, two by the county, and then one representing the library and other what are called taxing jurisdictions, so like the disability fund and things like that. And they will make a recommendation whether this project is appropriate for TIFF or not. And regardless of the recommendation, it goes up to the city council, who has the final say on whether the project should happen or not.
What are some of the things that get discussed in these deliberations about whether a project should or shouldn't get the funding?
Is this the, you know, does it, is it really blighted? So there will be a consultant's report, but it's not the final say. I mean, they can debate whether whether it really is blighted. They can determine whether the level of funding that they're seeking is appropriate for the type of project, whether it really fits into what TIFF should be doing. All those things are kind of debated. You can have some negotiations too. I mean, you can make agreements with the school district to give them payments in lieu of taxes, for instance, to offset the effect that it will have on a school district. And all these things just kind of get negotiated and then kicked up to the city council.
Can you give an example of a really successful TIFF project, a project that TIFF made possible?
Sure. The one that's frequently held up is sort of the best example of TIFF is the it's referred to as the Glover Plan, named after a former city council member who was in office at the time and helped pioneer it in certain ways. But it's the project where there's a Costco and a Home Depot over on Linwood in Maine. And that area before was a pretty hard scrabble part of town.
There was a pack of dogs, I remember.
Right. It was not a great place by any stretch, or even a decent place. And it got turned into these large retailers. And it gets criticized sometimes because Home Depot and Costco tend to be more suburban type developments. But they pay pretty good wages. I think they pay benefits and things like that. So it's a good job opportunity for people who live in Midtown. And it's been pretty successful because it's a well-trafficked, popular destination for people to do shopping. So
has there been a more controversial example?
Yeah, there have been several. I mean, one that's sort of in the middle of the road is the Power and Light District was financed through TIFF. But because of the way that the projections, because people thought that the Power and Light District was going to make much more money than it did, the bondholders invested in it with a certain expectation. The revenue that's been generated by Power and Light does not meet those expectations, and so the taxpayers subsidize it to the tune of about $12 million a year, and will continue to do that until 2040.
Yeah, so there's a time frame for these TIFF projects, like a time frame that the developer has to benefit from the funding.
Right. It's supposed to be 23 years. Sometimes they end early. Sometimes they get extended. Sometimes different projects get approved within it, which extends it even further. So the time frame is somewhat ephemeral.
What are you watching with this whole issue between Shirley Helzberg, BNIM, the TIFF Commission, and the city today, as far as the crossroads goes?
Well, I think the important thing to watch in this is the discussion about, you know, when is it appropriate for taxpayers to get involved in private developments and to what level, and whether there should be more judicious use of these tools. They're important tools. Anybody who says that TIFF is always bad is missing it. People who say TIFF is always good and always needed are probably missing it too. There's some nuance in this. And I think the discussion going forward with this project is going to be, should TIFF be used ongoing in the crossroads and downtown places that have gotten these types of tools? Should they continue to get them? Should they also be used more in places that are very blighted, like the East Side, where TIFF is used relatively sparingly, if barely, hardly at all? I think that's the policy discussion going forward.
Do we know why it's used so sparingly in those areas?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, which would probably require a lot of show, but a different show. But the East Side typically hasn't been as attractive to developers. And if they know they can get TIFF downtown, Crossroads, and the Plaza, where TIFF is used a lot, that's where they will opt to go.
Sadly, our time is up for this conversation about TIFF in Kansas City. Steve Vakrot of The Pitch, thanks for joining us and explaining it all.
Thanks for having me on.
You can listen back to our discussion about the history of the Crossroads as well as this explainer on how TIFF works at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. That way you'll never miss an episode. Tomorrow, tune in for stories of Kansas Cityans who were tangled in the news, sometimes inadvertently, sometimes deliberately, over this past year. That's tomorrow at 10. Tune in. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. We had lots of help today from associate producer Jen Chen and contributor Andrea Tudhope. I'm Gina Kaufman, signing off. Up to Date is next.